Good morning. It's very good to be here, and I thank ISDA for the invitation to come and speak to you today. This conference is taking place at a very interesting and challenging time for the global financial system. Obviously, a good deal of attention right now is focused on Europe, on the problems of sovereign debt, and on the interaction between that and the condition of the European banking system. As we all know, this is a significant source of uncertainty for the rest of the world. Policymakers are working hard to find solutions that will rebuild confidence, but the situation is still fluid and it remains an area that will need to be closely watched. In Australia, meanwhile, the financial system is continuing to perform relatively well. The broad outlines of that story, I think, are well known. In Australia, we didn't have a financial crisis or a recession during the GFC. Our banks are profitable, they're well capitalised, and their overall asset quality remains good. We can't, of course, expect the Australian system to be entirely immune from the unfolding events in Europe, but a couple of points are worth emphasising on that score. The first is that the Australian banks have only very limited direct exposures to sovereign debt in the countries that are most at risk. So the potential effects on Australian banks' overall balance sheet quality is not an issue. The second point is that since the height of the GFC, the Australian banks have done a lot to strengthen their funding positions. They've increased their use of domestic deposits as a funding source. They've lengthened the average term of their wholesale liabilities, and they've correspondingly reduced their reliance on short-term wholesale debt. These things will help the Australian banks to be more resilient to the uncertainties that are now affecting international credit markets. As important as the current challenges are, financial regulators around the world are focusing not just on that, but also on longer-term regulatory reforms. The reform effort is proceeding on a number of fronts aimed at building a more robust financial system for the longer term and thereby reducing the risk of future crises. Many of those efforts are being coordinated internationally through the G20 process, through the Financial Stability Board, and through standard-setting bodies like the Basel Committee. In all of those bodies, Australia is actively represented. In broad terms, the various reforms seek to draw lessons that emerged from the GFC, and they aim to remedy the weaknesses that became apparent during that period. Hence, among other things, there's a significant effort to build up the amount of capital in the global banking system and to strengthen banks' liquidity management. Even though, as I said, we didn't have a banking crisis here during the GFC, the Australian regulators recognise the importance of raising standards in these areas, and we're working on implementation of the various international initiatives in all of those areas that I've just mentioned, and others as well. One particular piece of the picture that has absorbed a lot of our attention at the Reserve Bank has been the work on financial market infrastructure, and particularly in relation to OTC derivatives clearing. I know this is a very important area for ISDA members who are here today, and it's on this topic that I want to focus my main remarks. I'll be basing my remarks on the discussion paper released by the Council of Financial Regulators in June, and it's my intention today to highlight some of the main issues that came out of that paper rather than to draw policy conclusions. At the Pittsburgh summit in September 2009, G20 leaders agreed, among other things, to a common commitment to central clearing in key derivatives markets. To quote from the relevant part of the communique, it states that all standardised OTC derivatives contracts should be traded on exchanges or electronic trading platforms where appropriate, and cleared through central counterparties by end 2012 at the latest. Australia was part of that agreement, and the Australian regulatory agencies, like those in other G20 jurisdictions, are working through the issues associated with implementing it. In focusing on that today, I want to look at three questions. Why is there a general case for promoting central clearing? What are the complexities involved in that? And where does the process stand in Australia? So first, why central clearing? Well, in general terms, the case for promoting central clearing in derivatives markets is based on the aim of reducing systemic risk by managing interconnectedness. In markets without central clearing, counterparty exposures build up bilaterally, and in certain kinds of products, they can accumulate to very large notional amounts over time. In many cases, that might not be a problem, but where the interconnections are extensive enough, they can be a source of systemic risk. The risks from those exposures might be well managed by individual institutions, but an institution can't be sure that its dealings with others don't expose it to a lower standard of risk control practiced by that counterparty. Even more so, it can't be sure about the quality of indirect exposures to anyone else in the market through the network of bilateral trades. The clearing process, by novating positions to a central counterparty, allows risks to be centrally managed to a standard acceptable by the market and by its regulators. And with legally enforceable multilateral netting, gross exposures can be drastically reduced. As long as the CCP is itself robust, the effect should be to reduce the scope for contagion and thereby limit the impact on the market if one or more participants fail. The experience with resolving the Lehman failure in 2008 testifies to the effectiveness of that mechanism in a crisis. We might also expect that confidence in this mechanism will help to underpin liquidity in the market during periods of financial stress. All of that presupposes that the CCP is itself robust. Of course, CCPs themselves have a strong incentive to control risk because they are, after all, in the risk control business. But it also points to the need for appropriate regulatory standards to ensure that the risk controls in a CCP are commensurate with its significance for the wider system. Subject to that proviso, central clearing can be expected to reduce aggregate counterparty risk by replacing a web of bilateral exposures with a set of potentially much smaller net exposures to a CCP with robust risk management. Individual participants benefit from the risk reduction, but importantly, so does the stability of the system as a whole. In a nutshell, that's the basic case for promoting central clearing as a policy objective in systemically important derivatives markets. That brings me to my second question: what about the complexities? When talking about these things in the abstract, it's easy to talk as though a central counterparty is truly central. But in fact, as we all know, it's not that simple. There's a huge array of markets in financial instruments around the world, and there are multiple CCPs for different instruments. Some instruments are centrally cleared already, many are not. Not all instruments are good candidates for central clearing, because they're not sufficiently standardised and they can't readily be made so. It's also important to recognise that not all market participants are alike. They can't all be expected to have direct access to the major CCPs even when the new structures are fully in place. So the abstract model in which all participants are connected to the central clearer won't be realised in practice. For all these reasons, the optimal configuration of clearing arrangements in the real world is far from obvious, and the way global markets will evolve in response to a mandatory clearing requirement in various jurisdictions is hard to predict. Another complication is the question of interconnectivity between clearers. A central clearer, as I said, should in some sense be central. In theory, netting benefits might be maximised by a single global CCP clearing all the major instruments with all active traders as members and all positions included in the scope of multilateral netting. It's not clear, actually, that such an outcome would be desirable, even if it were possible. It would amount to a massive concentration of risk at a single point and would give rise to complex operational issues and questions of jurisdictional oversight. But in any case, even if such an outcome were desirable, it won't be achieved. The closest alternative might be to provide links between CCPs so as to allow trades to be cleared between participants in different CCPs. The question of how that might eventually occur, or even whether it's achievable at all, then becomes very important. The weight of expert opinion is that the capacity to develop these links is still a good way off. Links between CCPs also raise complex questions about the transmission of risks from one CCP to another, and these will need to be carefully studied. For the foreseeable future, then, we'll be in a world in which there is a collection of CCPs, each of which has a source of competitive advantage in its own location or its own area of specialisation. That advantage might derive from historical legacy, or it might arise because the market that the CCP is servicing has some natural home in its own location. But these markets are going to remain contestable, and so the configuration of CCPs around the world is likely to stay fluid, not least because the market will be rapidly evolving in response to changing regulatory conditions. It's in this very unpredictable environment that the domestic regulators are considering the policy framework for central clearing in Australia. Before I come to that, it's worth just reviewing a few general facts about the Australian OTC derivatives market. The largest component in terms of the amounts outstanding is the market for single currency interest rate swaps, the bulk of which are Australian dollar denominated. Australian banks, both locally incorporated and foreign bank branches, have aggregate notional principal amounts outstanding in this market of about $8 trillion. But banks operating in Australia are not the only entities to transact in this market. From a jurisdictional point of view, we can, in principle at least, divide transactions in the global market for Australian dollar derivatives into three types, namely local to local, local to foreign, and entirely foreign. In fact, the distinction between a local and an offshore market participant is not entirely straightforward because many local participants are affiliated with offshore entities. But that said, the available data suggests that all three of the transaction types that I've just mentioned form a significant share of the market. Most of the activity that involves the large foreign banks as the two counterparties is already cleared through LCH Swap Clear, while the remainder of the market is currently uncleared. It is, of course, misleading in another way to talk about these three parts of the market as if they were separable. They are, in fact, closely interdependent, and the liquidity in each of those three parts depends upon and is supported by the liquidity in the other parts. As a related point, the Australian dollar market is itself interdependent with other global markets and specifically with derivatives markets in other currencies. The regulatory agencies in Australia have indicated that they view the Australian dollar IR swaps market as being systemically important for the domestic financial system. That assessment reflects a number of considerations, including the size of the market, its fundamental role in hedging domestic interest rate risk, and the long duration of counterparty risk in these instruments. At the same time, though, Although the market is large in relation to the Australian financial system, it's not large in global terms. The next largest OTC derivatives market in Australia is for FX-related derivatives, in which the Australian banking system has a notional principal outstanding of about $4 trillion. Other OTC markets, such as those for commodity derivatives, are much smaller at this stage, but that's not to say that they don't have the potential to grow over time. For various reasons, international regulators at this stage are giving priority in their regulatory strategies to their single currency interest rate swap markets. Among the reasons for that is that these instruments are often of relatively long duration and they have very large amounts outstanding. Another factor is that cross-currency instruments, which are the next biggest market, give rise to more complex jurisdictional issues. In Australia, for similar reasons, any mandatory clearing policy is likely to focus initially on the Australian dollar interest rate swaps market. At the heart of the policy challenge are two interrelated questions. First, should there be a mandatory clearing requirement in this market? And secondly, if so, should it include a locational requirement to the effect that trades be cleared by a locally incorporated and locally regulated CCP? Since there is no domestic CCP offering that service currently, that would involve requiring industry to come up with a solution that meets the regulatory objectives. There are many factors that will have a bearing on this decision, but I think they boil down to finding a balance between two objectives, namely stability and efficiency. The stability consideration comes from the point that I made at the outset. The purpose of promoting central clearing is to reduce systemic risk. CCPs reduce risk in one important respect, but they also concentrate it in a specific location. Where a market is systemically important to the Australian economy, this points to a case for the CCP that clears that market to be subject to appropriate safeguards that control the propagation of risk to domestic participants. That might be best achieved where the CCP is locally incorporated and subject to domestic regulation. At the least, it argues that the CCP should be subject to safeguards that take into account its systemic significance to the Australian market. The second set of considerations are those related to efficiency. We have to recognise that even for instruments that are denominated solely in Australian dollars, the market is a global one. The cost effectiveness of a local CCP will first depend to a significant degree on global forces. I've tried to highlight the uncertainties involved in predicting how the global market will evolve. Related to that, a number of the submissions to our consultation process have emphasised the risk of splitting the Australian dollar market if any local clearing mandate turns out to be not sufficiently effective. The cost effectiveness and viability of a local CCP for this market is also going to depend on aspects of the international regulatory environment that are not yet determined. In particular, that includes the extent of eventual mutual recognition of CCPs across borders by their respective regulators. We need to avoid an outcome where internationally active banks find themselves subject to inconsistent requirements among the jurisdictions in which they operate. On that front, I note that the Financial Stability Board has recently begun discussions on the challenges of mutual recognition, although these are still at an early stage. Adding further to the complexity is that the environment is already being shaped by regulatory developments in the major jurisdictions, especially in the United States and Europe. Australian entities that are active in those markets will need to meet the clearing requirements that come into force there soon, and they will also be affected indirectly to the extent that they deal with counterparties that are subject to those jurisdictions. In the United States, the Dodd-Frank regulations on OTC clearing are likely to start taking effect from around the second quarter of next year. And in Europe, the corresponding regulations under EMIR are likely to take effect by around 2013. Even before then, market behaviour, and hence the environment for the Australian banks, is going to be influenced by the anticipation of those requirements. In broad outline then, those are some of the key considerations that will need to be taken into account in determining the way forward in Australia. And that brings me to my third question, which is, where does the policy process in Australia now stand? In June, as you know, the Council of Financial Regulators released a discussion paper setting out these issues in detail and calling for submissions from interested parties. To help focus that discussion, the Council paper put forward four propositions, and in summary, these were that in the absence of Australian regulatory action, domestic CCP solutions may not emerge, that where a market is of systemic importance to Australia, a move to offshore central clearing might introduce risks to the Australian financial system that don't currently exist, that the Council agencies considered the market for Australian dollar interest rate swaps to be systemically important within Australia, and that in light of this, the Council agencies were considering the case for a requirement that those instruments be centrally cleared, and as part of that, were considering whether such clearing should take place domestically. I stress that those were not conclusions. They were preliminary propositions that the Council agencies were seeking to test. In response to the paper, we've received around 30 submissions, including one from ISDA, a good number from individual ISDA members, who are no doubt represented here today, and others from a range of other market participants and interested parties. Most of the submissions are available on the Reserve Bank website. Council agencies have also engaged in a series of follow-up meetings with those who have made submissions. I've participated in a number of those myself, and I can say that I've appreciated the spirit in which the industry has made its input into the process. If I've conveyed anything today, it's that these are difficult and complex issues. Most of the submissions have stressed that point, and there was a strong view coming through from industry that it's important to take the time to get it right. We take the complexities seriously, and we need to continue engaging with industry in the process of determining the best way forward. That said, the Council's advice on these matters, when it's made, will be determined by the public policy considerations of stability and efficiency that I've just outlined. Not all industry participants are going to have the same commercial interests, and they're not all going to be of the same view as to their preferred outcomes. But where the industry contributions are valuable is in helping to make clearer what are the costs and benefits and the risks of the alternative approaches. We hope to be in a position to put forward some conclusions from the consultation process soon, but I can't foreshadow those today. In the meantime, I take the opportunity to thank all of those who have made constructive contributions, and I look forward to continued engagement with you. Thank you. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much for the address today, Assistant Governor Eadie.
I just wanted to see, obviously you mentioned a lot of the international coordination that's necessary. It's been a big area of concern for our membership globally, but particularly here down in Australia, as it relates to some of those efforts by certain jurisdictions to reach well beyond their borders to oppose regulations or to sweep them into regulatory requirements in the jurisdiction. I guess, how do you envision trying to achieve some consistency at the international level? What are the best avenues, and what is going to be the RBA's and the council's involvement in trying to push some of that consistency forward?
Thanks. So the question is how to promote the appropriate international cooperation in this area. It's very important to remain engaged, to keep talking. There are some formal vehicles for doing that. Probably the most important one is the Financial Stability Board and the various Basel-related committees. Australia is represented on all of those. I indicated in my earlier remarks that the Financial Stability Board has begun discussions specifically about the question of mutual recognition. That's a very important topic because of the issue that you raised, that laws like the Dodd-Frank law will have extraterritorial effects. And so that's obviously going to have an influence on what's achievable here. I think the main thing I can say is we need to be engaged and to try and influence that and to do what we can to promote appropriate mutual recognition. But we also have to recognise that these are very complicated issues. Even with the best will in the world, every country is facing its own complex regulatory challenges, and coordinating all of that is a difficult task. So there can be no guarantees as to how quickly internationally coordinated recognition can be put in place. And we need to be realistic about that domestically and to take that into account in the way that we formulate our domestic solution.
Thank you. Assistant Governor Eady, in your studies of possible clearing in Australia, when you look at the size of the market, are you concerned at all about the cost side, the amount of margin required for the banks to participate in CCPs, the clearing costs, and how those costs might be transferred to end clients that, in a way that makes it more expensive for them to hedge their liabilities and may dissuade them from doing appropriate risk management? Thank you.
Well, that particular issue is something that has been a subject of a number of the submissions. I think the general point that has been made is that any kind of mandatory requirement is going to add to costs. If a regulator requires anybody to do things that they're not doing now, I think the expectation is that there will be some cost involved in that. And the thing that the regulators have to do is to make some sort of a judgment on a cost-benefit basis as to whether it's cost-effective to do so. It, as I've tried to indicate today, it's going to be very difficult to make those judgments. I think the figures show that the IR swaps market in Australia is big domestically, so there is some scale there that can potentially help to reduce unit costs. But as I also indicated, our market is not large compared to the global market, and so we're going to need to take that cost-benefit trade-off into account, but I don't think I can get any more specific than that at this stage.
An opportunity to discuss with regional regulators a concept of perhaps a jointly regulated regional CCP construction. It seems that trying to jointly regulate something on a more global basis seems like a step too far, but perhaps a regional one might be more amenable to, you know, Japan, Singapore, New Zealand, Australia kind of joint regulation type process. Would that be driven by market participants coming back to the council with an idea, or has the council had that sort of discussion with other peer regulators offshore?
We've had a lot of discussions with other countries that are in a similar position to ourselves about determining the way forward. And there are a number of countries that are in a similar position to Australia, Japan, Korea, to give you a couple of examples, Canada, though it's not in our region, is facing a very similar policy challenge to the one that we're facing. And you can imagine that all of those countries are finding the situation equally challenging. I don't rule out that there could be some kind of regional solution in the longer term, but I think the way that we need to proceed as a policy process is first to try to determine what are the domestic objectives that we're trying to safeguard, and then work with industry to work out what are the realistic ways of delivering that. So I think that's the sequence we would follow, rather than trying to start off with a top-down idea of having aiming for a regional solution and then trying to work out what we think it can deliver.
The council paper discusses in quite in depth about the central clearing. Is there any feedback on the G20 commitment of mandating of electronic trading platforms in suitably liquid OTC products such as interest rate swaps in Australia?
All of these things are on the agenda because they are included in the G20 commitment, although you'll notice that the wording of the G20 commitment includes the qualifier where appropriate for the particular issue that you've just mentioned, which is electronic trading. So implicitly that already, I think, gives it a slightly lesser priority than the central clearing issue. In Australia, we, because these issues are so complex and they require specialised resources amongst the regulators to study them and to engage with industry, we've had to prioritise. And the position at the moment is that we are prioritising the clearing issue. So the other issues of electronic trading and trade repositories, which is also part of that broader commitment, they're on the agenda for study, but we've had to give priority to the central clearing issue.
With all the complexity that you just mentioned, would you think there would be enough time for the regulators, together with the Australian market participants, to have a clearing solution by end of 2012, or you think more time will be needed to achieve that?
Well, the wording of the G20 commitment is quite absolute, actually. It says all standardised products, but I think what we're seeing around the world is that everybody, including in the big jurisdictions, is seeing that this is more complicated than it might have first looked, and so timetables are being extended everywhere. I think the approach that we will take is that it's important to take the time to get it right. That's what I said earlier, rather than sticking to the letter of the end 2012. But it may well be that things that are already in process will deliver substantial compliance with that objective anyway. One of the things that I didn't mention was that the Basel III banking regulations that are currently being finalised will include a specification in the capital standards that will provide an incentive for banks to use CCPs. In addition to that, the existence of Dodd-Frank law and the anticipation of that and the effect of that on the major global banks is already going to be steering the market as a whole towards greater use of central clearing. So it's quite possible that those mechanisms that are already in place will steer the Australian market towards a high degree of compliance with the end 2012 objective, even without the permanent solution being in place by then. But as far as that last point is concerned, I think it's better if I don't rule anything in or out as far as the exact timetable is concerned.